In a surprise plea agreement, a Montana newlywed pleads guilty to killing her husband. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
In part two of our ongoing series on the Bakken, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce visits with the Sydney Herald newspaper's longtime editor. And in our feature interview, news reporter Edward O'Brien talks with federal grizzly bear recovery coordinator Chris Servine about delisting the great bear. A Montana newlywed pleaded guilty today to killing her husband of 8 days by pushing him from a cliff in Glacier National Park while they argued about her second thoughts about the marriage. The surprise plea agreement with prosecutors came just before closing arguments were set to begin in the trial of 22-year-old Jordan Graham. In exchange for the guilty plea to second-degree murder, prosecutors agreed to drop the first-degree murder charge and a count of making a false statement to authorities. Graham could face a maximum sentence of life in prison when she is sentenced on March 27th. In accepting the plea, U.S. District Judge Donald Malloy told Graham to recount exactly what happened the night of July 7th when her husband, 25-year-old Cody Johnson, fell to his death in the park. Graham said she told Johnson she wasn't happy and wasn't feeling like she should after getting married. They argued, and at one point she said he grabbed her by the arm and she thought he was going to pull her. She told the judge she got angry at Johnson, brushed his hand away, and then pushed him, with one hand on his arm and one hand on his back. She said she then drove back to her home in Kalispell without calling for help because she was so afraid. She did not know what to do. U.S. Marshals led Graham away in handcuffs.
And in other news from around the state, Lake County officials have made a fourth arrest in a pair of weekend shootings in Pablo. Kerr AM reports 24-year-old Luis Mateo Denobrega was arrested yesterday after his vehicle crashed near St. Ignatius while being pursued by officers. Denobrega faces a charge of attempted deliberate homicide. Investigators believe Denobrega fired 5 shotgun blasts at a house Saturday night. No one was injured, but there were children inside. On Sunday, someone used a handgun to fire shots at a trailer in Pablo in what Undersheriff Dan Yonkin believes was retaliation for the Saturday night shooting. 3 men were arrested after Sunday's shooting. Yonkin says 19-year-old Jonathan Drennan Beck is charged with attempted deliberate homicide, while 19-year-old Francis Burke and 18-year-old Victor Barnaby are charged with felony conspiracy. All 3 also face a drug possession charge.
A man who recently moved from Alaska to Missoula is charged with incest for allegedly having sex with his 19-year-old mentally disabled daughter. The 48-year-old man was charged in justice court in Missoula yesterday. The man's bail was set at $50,000. Charging documents say law enforcement officers received a call from Child Protective Services on Tuesday. When contacted by investigators, the man denied the accusation. Court records say the daughter told investigators she knew it was illegal and that she should go to jail because her father had children to take care of. Deputy Missoula County Attorney Jennifer Clark says the daughter has mental disabilities and her father was taking advantage of her. The Associated Press generally does not identify victims of sexual abuse and is not naming the father to avoid identifying the daughter.
Leaders from around the West met today to strategize about wildfire management. Governors from several states discussed ways to prevent and put out wildfires during the annual winter meetings of the Western Governors Association on the Las Vegas Strip. Established in 1984, the association includes governors from 19 Western states. Members share ideas, concerns, and approaches to dealing with issues unique to the West. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell delivered a keynote address this morning, highlighting the federal government's commitment to collaborating on conservation and land management issues. She told an audience of officials that climate change is real and seen most clearly in the West.
Covering news in the eastern Montana town of Sydney has been a changing business over the past 5 years. Front pages depicting the life and times of a sleepy farm town now include headlines about a booming population, a booming economy, and crime. This month, we're bringing you a series of stories on the side effects of the Bakken oil boom, positive and negative. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has the story.
So this is the project. It's 140 acres. This is Sunrise.
Sydney, we're sitting here right it's growing. Here, some land developers are showing off a scale model of a new subdivision going in.
This is the largest subdivision that's ever been built in the city.
It's called Sunrise Village.
Size-wise, how much bigger does this make Sydney?
Bill Vanderweel scribbles in a reporter's notebook, still wearing his thick green down coat.
I'm the editor.
He's the editor of the Sydney Herald. He's been at the twice-weekly paper for 29 years.
I guess the main thing is the oil impact.
That's so much of what he reports on now.
The majority of our stories are related to oil in some way.
At school board meetings,
the next couple of years, we might have 1,500 more students.
Will the town need to build another school?
Or if we cover city council,
the community doesn't have enough money to improve strained infrastructure. Restaurants can't find employees when people can make so much more out on the oil rigs. Vanderweel says the boom is bringing a lot of really positive things.
But these are the side effects that the community is kind of dealing with.
The hardest story to cover, and what's changed the community the most, he says that's been the January 2012 murder of Sydney High School teacher Sherry Arnold.
The community kind of lost some of his innocence when that happened.
She was kidnapped while on a morning jog. Her abductors allegedly grabbed her from the street, choked her, and buried her in a shallow grave.
Because of that, people kind of look at outsiders a little more differently. We lock our doors a little more. We are a little more cautious than we used to be, and probably a little less friendly than we used to be.
Ultimately, though, Vanderweel says he does still feel safe in this town.
Sydney's not a dangerous place.
And the paper is trying to show that. That's why they started Bakken Living.
It's going to be a quarterly magazine about living life in this part of the country.
That's Herald publisher Robert Arrowsmith. The cover of the first issue has a happy, bundled-up family lying in the snow. It highlights the different communities in the Bakken, the people here, the culture.
We want people to know that life isn't about the stigma that Sydney has at the moment. You know, you don't want Sherry Arnold to be your top search 2 years later. There is good community life out here, and that's part of the thing we're trying to do editorially is help promote that.
We'll have a front page here somewhere.
Sports reporter Sarah Bloom has pulled out a big book of old papers from the 90s, a time when some houses cost less to buy than it costs now to rent them for a year. A time when headlines suggested a simpler way of life.
Nashua woman wins ceramic doll award at show.
Yet, she says even with the oil boom as big as it is in this part of the world, her paper still finds space for stories like that. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting in Sydney.
State-licensed hunters could take more bison migrating from Yellowstone National Park under a proposal that has cleared an initial hurdle with Montana wildlife commissioners. Today's preliminary approval sets up a February 13th final vote on the plan to increase quotas on future bison hunts and allow hunting in new areas. Members of Indian tribes acting under treaty rights took the vast majority of the 744 bison shot by hunters over the last decade. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks spokesman Ron Ossheim says the agency wants more comparable opportunities for state-licensed hunters. The maximum annual quota on Yellowstone bison would increase from 150 to 200 animals. Hunting would be newly allowed in areas south and west of Hebgen Lake. The proposal is contingent on an environmental study, which is now underway.
A panel of wildlife officials says it's time to lift endangered species protections for grizzly bears in and around Yellowstone National Park. Members of the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee voted unanimously this week in favor of ending the federal protections. The committee's recommendation will now be considered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Environmental groups worried about climate change say it's too early to take the bears off the threatened list. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Grizzly Bear Recovery Coordinator Chris Servine says there are over 700 grizzlies in the Yellowstone ecosystem population, increasing at about 1% to 1.5% annually. He says there are about 1,000 grizzlies in the Glacier Bob Marshall Complex, which he says is growing by about 3% annually. Servine says there are about 45 grizzlies in the northwest Montana's Cabinet Yak region. That population is holding steady, not growing or declining much. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Servine talks about the reasoning behind this week's decision on the Yellowstone population. Declining whitebark pine stands in the ecosystem played a significant role in that decision. Those stands have been affected by blister rust and the mountain pine beetle.
Grizzly bears eat the nuts in the pine cones. Many other species eat those nuts, too, because they're rich in fats and proteins, and they're valuable to them. What we see, though, is that grizzly bears do not eat them every year because the trees under natural conditions don't produce nuts every year. Some years they produced a lot of cones. Some years they don't produce any cones. So under normal conditions, bears eat them when they're available. And in some years they don't have any cones and they eat other things. So they're used to switching back and forth between other foods. What we've seen with the double whammy of the blister rust and the mountain pine beetle is a decline in white bark production in the Yellowstone ecosystem, and therefore less and less white bark available for the bears to eat.
Cutthroat trout as well.
Cutthroat trout as well, right.
Speaking of double whammy, that's a double whammy.
It is, but cutthroats are a species that are available during a very small time period, about 2 weeks, where they enter the spawning streams around Yellowstone Lake, and they're available to the bears. The rest of the time, they're in the lake, and the bears can't get to them at all. What we've seen is a decline in the cutthroat trout because somebody introduced lake trout into Yellowstone Lake. In the big picture of things, cutthroats were never a major food for grizzly bears in Yellowstone because they're available for a very small time period, and perhaps 5 to 10% of the bears actually took advantage of them for that two-week period.
What else do they eat then?
Oh, they eat a wide range of foods. There are several hundred foods that bears have been known to eat in the Yellowstone ecosystem, 75 of which are eaten on a frequent basis. Insects, plant material, berries, animals, either dead animals or animals that are killed. But let's get back to the white bark issue, because the white bark is the big issue that the courts kind of held us up on when we talked about delisting the Yellowstone bears.
Correct.
We were upheld on all the issues when we proposed delisting, except the issue of declines in white bark. And the courts told us that they were not convinced that declines in white bark would not threaten the grizzly bear. And that's why the grizzly bear recovery and delisting was overturned by the federal courts. And so we went back in the spring of 2012 and evaluated what to do. Should we give up on recovery and delisting forever? Should we propose another rule with what we knew at that point? Or should we produce a very detailed food synthesis on how the changes in foods in the Yellowstone ecosystem are affecting the health and welfare of the Yellowstone grizzly population? What we chose to do was to produce that food synthesis, and it was led by USGS, which is the science arm of the Department of Interior. They took 18 months to produce this document, and they very comprehensively examined not just declines in white bark, but all other foods. And they measured various things. For example, we can measure the body fat in individual bears. Every time we catch a bear, we can measure the body fat within a couple percent. One of the hypotheses was, well, if foods are declining, particularly white bark, then the bears wouldn't be as fat over time. And particularly in poor white bark years, they would be thinner and there wouldn't be as much fat. Looking at that, there's no difference in the body condition of grizzly bears in either good or bad white bark years. And there's been no difference in the body fat of grizzly bears before white bark started to decline, and now when it's been declining for some time.
Am I wrong in saying that right about when the white bark population started to decline, the grizzly population slowed a little bit?
It did. It slowed about 2000. The decline in white bark started about 2001. And so there was a break point. The population was increasing at about 7% per year, and then it started to level out into about 1% to 2% per year, about the year 2000. If you'd see a slowing of population growth that way, it could be because the foods are declining and the bears aren't reproducing as much and they're not as good in body condition. Or are the bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem starting to fill all the available habitat? As the populations get denser and denser, they compete with foods with each other. They compete with space with each other, and they start to slow down in population growth. And every indicator that they measured showed that it was related to density-dependent effects and not declines in white bark. The population in Yellowstone is pretty much achieving carrying capacity. We know that it's been in carrying capacity in the Yellowstone area, in the national park, for some time. That population is full, quote unquote. Outside, as the bears occupy all the available space and public lands in the Yellowstone ecosystem, they're basically starting to slow down because they filled the space. Remember, when the bear was listed, they occupied about 9,200 square miles in the Yellowstone ecosystem. Today, they occupy over 19,000 square miles. Grizzly bears have occupied places in the Yellowstone ecosystem where they've been gone for more than 100 years. So we see them down in the Wind River Range and the Owl Creek Range and the Beartooth Plateau. We see more and more bears close to Red Lodge and places like that, places where they've been gone for a long time.
I'm going to go back just 1 second. The food study that you were talking about, critics say it, A, has not been peer-reviewed, and B, presented to the public.
The report that was presented to the IGBC and is out on the website went through internal USGS peer review, where two independent peer reviewers reviewed the report, made comments to the study team, and they had to incorporate all those comments into the document before it was released. So it was peer-reviewed. Secondly, each of the individual studies that are in that overall report have either already been submitted and are in publication or will soon be submitted and into peer review. So over the next 6 months, every one of those individual studies will be in peer-reviewed documents as well. So we're looking at actually a double peer review.
IGBC this week made a fairly significant recommendation, and it is not to delist. Explain what this decision is and what it means.
Okay, the ultimate authority to list or delist a species lies with the Fish and Wildlife Service. The IGBC doesn't make a recommendation to delist or not. What they did was they recommended that based on the results of this food report is that we proceed to build a new proposed rule and put that out for public comment. When we delist something, we build a proposed rule, we put it in the Federal Register for public comment, 120 days of public comment, then we evaluate those comments, and then reach a final decision. That final decision is what actually delists the species. It'll probably be sometime in 2015 that the final decision would be made if we decide to build a new rule.
How big would the recovery zone in the Yellowstone ecosystem be? About 6 million acres-ish?
You know, I can't tell you what it is in acres. It's about 9,200 square miles is the recovery zone. And by the way, most of the bears live within that 9,200 square miles. As you go further outside there, the density of bears drops off. So they do occupy up to 19,000 square miles in the system, but the majority of the bears live inside the recovery zone, or after delisting, it would be called the primary conservation area. And to give you a feel for that, Yellowstone National Park is about 3,400 square miles. So about a third of that recovery zone is Yellowstone National Park, and then the rest of it is national forest land. Now, it's important to realize that within the core area, that 9,400 square miles, there are limits on no new road development, no new livestock allotments, and no new site developments. And that is institutionalized upon delisting of the grizzly bear.
What sort of hunting opportunities would a potential delisting open up for the grizzly?
I can't say if there would be sport hunting or how much. I know that it would be very carefully regulated. It's important to realize that there are strict limits on human-caused mortality that would be in place. Human-caused mortality from all sources. If hunting took place, it would have to take place within that sustainable mortality limit as well. It's very carefully managed. It would be probably a very limited number if it happened, and it would never be anything that would threaten the grizzly bear.
In this age of shrinking funding, sequestration, ceaseless budget bickering in D.C., what would this cost, and where would the money come from?
Right now, it costs us about $3 million a year to manage and monitor the Yellowstone grizzly population. And we would continue that same level of management and monitoring after delisting.
It would hold at 3 million or?
You bet. The reason that it would is that we built this very gold-plated management plan, which is called the conservation strategy, which has been upheld by the court system, that would be the post-delisting management plan. And it calls for all this careful monitoring and management that would continue, whether the bears delisted or not.
If it happens, what happens after the Yellowstone ecosystem?
Well, the next one in line is the Northern Continental Divide population. Now, that population is about 1,000 grizzly bears. That's in the Glacier Bob Marshall Complex. We've already written the draft post-delisting management plan there called the Conservation Strategy. We're right now incorporating all the public comments into that document. When we're done with that, we'll begin to write the rule to propose the delist the NCDE population as well, because that population is very healthy and robust as well. We have grizzly bears moving all the way out toward Great Falls on the prairie, south of Ovando, way south into the Blackfoot Valley. We've got them crossing to the west, crossing Highway 93 into the Flathead River on the Indian Reservation up there and into the Salish Mountains to the north.
What do you have to say to Montanans, rural Montanans in particular, who are concerned about growing populations of these large, powerful predators in their, and I'm doing the air quote, backyards, if you will?
What we tell the public and what we commit to them is that when there are conflicts between humans and bears, that we will deal with those bears and manage those conflicts. So if somebody has a problem, we'll go in and help them out, all the way from providing electric fencing assistance, so that if they have chickens or livestock where maybe there's depredations, we'll put electric fences around them, help them providing bear-proof garbage containers, educating them about how to minimize conflicts, say don't leave dog food on the porch and then you won't have bears on the porch. All the way to the point that if there is a conflict, we'll capture and relocate those bears. And if need be, there's repeated conflicts, we'll remove them. It's also important for everybody to recognize that the majority of grizzly bears are not involved in conflicts and don't have anything to do with people. And just because grizzly bears are in an area doesn't mean you're going to have conflicts. Usually the conflicts arise because people do things to bring bears into trouble. I mean, we need to build more knowledge into the public on how they can minimize their potential for conflict with bears, not just grizzly bears, but black bears as well. And we're committed to helping the public achieve that.
Last question, Chris, and that is, you're not a wolf guy. I'm not going to drag you into the wolf issue, but I'm curious, what have you and your colleagues learned about delisting from the wolf issue that could possibly be applicable to delisting of bears?
That's a good question. fundamental to achieving recovery is to make sure that the public is supportive of recovery and the species, and the political forces are supportive of the species. The way to do that is to maintain, careful management goals, and when we achieve those goals, which are recovery goals for these species, that we delist them and transfer management carefully over to the state agencies in terms of habitat management to the Forest Service, Park Service, and BLM. If we block that process where the public feels that they've invested a lot of effort in help achieving healthy populations, and yet recovery never occurs because of blockages in the federal court system, then they tend to throw up their hands and say, we're tired of it. That's essentially what happened with wolves. We eroded public and political support for wolves by the blockage of the recovery of wolves in the federal court system. That resulted in Congress getting involved in the delisting of the wolf and congressionally delisting the wolf in Idaho and Montana. The way it should be done is under the Endangered Species Act. When we achieve our goals, that we move forward and transition into recovered status with careful management under the ESA. The future of those bears and the future of their offspring lies with the people that are out there living, working, and recreating in bear habitat. And it's critical that we maintain their support.
But don't you think that animosity towards the wolf in some sectors of Montana is every bit a cultural thing? Montanans have long memories, and there was a lot of anger about wolves and their livestock, et cetera, et cetera. Does the same apply, that cultural, if you will, aspect apply to grizzlies?
We don't see the amount of animosity toward grizzly bears that people have toward wolves. Wolves generate so much emotion. You can go into any bar and restaurant in Montana and you can hear people around you talking about wolves. That's no right. matter where you go. That's right. And most of the information is not biologically correct. We don't see that with grizzly bears. And we don't want to get to that point with grizzly bears. People like having bears around. And in many places in Montana, ranchers like having bears on their property now. Whereas if they talk about the way their grandfather thought of bears, they wanted to get rid of them. Now we have guys on the Rocky Mountain front who live with grizzly bears and see grizzly bears every day on their property, and they like that.
Why?
I don't know. It's just, grizzly bears are neat. They're really neat animals to have around. We live in a very unique place that we have grizzly bears still here. Grizzly bears used to be found throughout the western United States, and there are very few areas where they're still here. We just have to balance the needs of people with the needs of bears.
United States Fish and Wildlife Service Grizzly Bear Recovery Coordinator Chris Servine, your time is valuable. Always good talking. Thank you.
Good talking to you, Ed. Thank you.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide in the Missoula Valley, air quality is currently unhealthy for sensitive groups and is expected to stay that way tonight. It'll slowly drop tomorrow. Tonight, it should be cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 15 to 22 degrees. Tomorrow, look for cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the 30s. In central Montana, there's a high wind warning in effect until 11 o'clock tonight on the Rocky Mountain front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows 10 to 25 degrees. Expect wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through the day and highs 25 to 35 degrees. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow through the night. Expect lows 10 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through today and highs 25 to 35 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Steve Turkowitz.
Good afternoon. I'd like to take a few minutes of your time to visit with you about Montana's banks and the role we play in our communities. Montana banks are fixtures in our communities, like the public schools, the grocery store, and our places of worship. Banks have their branches and roots in cities and towns across the country. And nowhere is that more true than right here in Montana. There are over 65 banks with more than 300 branches and 5,000 Montanans serving in our communities. Banks have played a major role in our community since our territorial days. Throughout the many changes in our cities, towns, and economy, one thing remains constant. There is no place more safe and secure to keep your hard-earned money than your local bank. We see the safety and security of your funds as one of our absolute highest priorities. Besides the bank's FDIC insurance, which premiums are paid for by banks, not customers, we have invested heavily in fraud monitoring and protection to help protect your money. Banks also make people's lives more convenient. Innovations like ATMs, debit cards, and online banking provide you with safe, secure, and convenient access to your money 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, throughout the entire year, at home or wherever your travels take you. Besides safety and security and convenience for our customers, we also focus on the community at large. Montana's banks have a stake in the economic growth, health, and vitality of our communities. Banks are partners in our communities. We provide credit for small businesses, helping them get started, grow, and prosper. Likewise, banks are the largest source of credit to Montana's farmers and ranchers. We are loaning more and more money to qualified individuals and local businesses. We understand that in many ways, credit can be financial oxygen to local neighborhoods, and we're working to meet those needs. And our involvement extends beyond the bank to our employees, too. They are committed to our community as the banks and as you are. Our employees are major sources for volunteers supporting the many community projects and programs throughout the state. We have been and are today a vibrant presence in each of our communities. Banks are also here to help you with your family's milestone events, whether it's buying your first home or car, planning for your retirement, sending your kids to college, or planning their weddings. We want to be here for you as your partner. On a different note, as we enter the holiday season, I'd like to share some tips to manage holiday spending and avoid a post-holiday credit hangover. As we all do our holiday shopping, we should keep in mind that January's bills will be arriving in just a few weeks. Wise and thoughtful budgeting for your holiday purchases can help you avoid bringing in the new year with last year's debt. First, create a budget and stick to it. Set a dollar amount based on what you can afford this holiday season, considering your current savings, income, and other expenses. Make a list. Write down the names of the people you plan to buy gifts for and how much you can afford to spend on each person. Bake some cookies, one of my favorites. Handmade gifts are a special way to say happy holidays without overspending. Be sure to include these costs in your budget. Use credit wisely. Take only the credit cards you need when holiday shopping and try to use the card with the lowest interest rate. Save your receipts. Keep track of your expenses and add them up weekly to be sure you're sticking to your budget. If you're getting close to your spending limit, reevaluate your list and bake more cookies. Shop around. Take time to do some research before you hit the stores by going online or looking at your local newspaper circulars. Holding true to one's budget during the busy holiday season is an excellent jumpstart to a healthy year-long budgeting habit. This has been Steve Turkowitz with the Montana Bankers Association, and on behalf of Montana's bankers and their families, happy holidays and best wishes for a prosperous and healthy new year.
Steve Turkowitz is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.